If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Richard got into a lot of trouble and a lot of shenanigans. As he got older, things got worse. He was smoking pot, and he used to say, "Mom, pot makes me feel normal." School was a trigger. He had ADD. He had lots of anxiety. Then he went into opioids. He ran away from home, and boop, FBI. "We'd like to talk to Richard, please." Those types of stories happened from that time when he was 17 until the time he passed away at 24.
Right. Can you just share a little bit about what it's like to get a call like that, to know that from that moment on, your life will never be the same? Explain what pivotal moments you went through or created for yourself to make the path for that joy for yourself, to learn how to live again after this loss.
I believe in the signs because I believe that there's an unstoppable power of love. All of a sudden, this huge monarch butterfly comes, circles my head, dances around the table, circles the table, dances around my head again, and then flutters off.
Today on Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel, we are joined by Anne Marie Farino, a remarkable woman who has turned unimaginable pain into a mission to help others. After losing her 24-year-old son, Richard, to suicide in 2016, Anne Marie dedicated her life to raising awareness about addiction, mental health, and the complex journey of grief. She is a powerful voice for breaking the stigma around these issues, offering guidance and hope to those who have experienced similar catastrophic loss. In this episode, we dive deep into what it's like to survive such profound loss, the challenge of finding joy and purpose again after, and her efforts to bring light into the often hidden struggles many families face. We'll also explore her insights on living with intention and how, even in the darkest times, there is a path forward. Join us as we have a meaningful conversation on finding our path to joy and happiness after loss with Anne Marie Farino. Anne Marie, thank you so much for joining me here in Palm Beach.
Thank you, Rachel, for having me.
Of course. So I want to paint a picture for the people that are listening or watching about life quite a while ago, but when you were a mother of three children and you were married and then you were not, you were a single mother, but kind of talk about
your kids' childhood, what it was like for you, your family, and for them.
Well, I have three children, Richard, Nick, and Catherine. And it was, you know, the busy house of the three kids. But Richard really kind of got into a lot of trouble and a lot of shenanigans. And so...
Like so many kids do.
Like so many kids do. But he's... And at first, I really didn't think much of it because I thought, he's a boy. They do these things. But as he grew older, the chaos kind of came into his life. And he started acting out. He loved to shock people, the shock and awe factor, whether it was his friends pulling pranks or, you know, he just liked to, especially he liked to get results in adults, especially. So he would say shocking things or do shocking things. And, you know, after a while, I started to get concerned that maybe I needed to get professional help for him.
Right. So wait, before you get into that, what was the age difference in the children? Tell us where you lived, that kind of thing. How old you were or how the kids were when the divorce happened?
The kids were, my daughter was 5 and middle son was 9 and Richard would have been 12.
Okay. Okay. And you were in Illinois?
We were in Illinois and we were in a little North Shore suburb of Chicago. And I always, you know, dubbed myself as the mom with the twin set and the pearls and the ballet flats and just very conservative.
Right.
But very, very happy. And I was a single mom for 5 years.
Yeah.
In those years, you know, we had a peaceful home and it was always stocked with everything they needed.
Right. Was there any issue with, I mean, my parents got divorced when I was little. You always hear about how that affected kids. Do you think that affected the kids or did they love it because then they could have time with you, then with him?
They did like the time alone. They really, really liked the time alone. And I think that then having every other weekend with their dad, you know, was enough. And that worked. But it kind of – things started happening at school with Richard.
Right.
He would talk to a teacher about guns. And then the teacher would call me in and say, oh, my gosh, you know, it was 2004 and – people were afraid of guns.
Yeah.
And I wasn't that worried because our family took gun safety very, very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't worried about it. But as he got older, things got worse. And he was smoking pot. And he used to say, Mom, pot makes me feel normal. So some of the early signs for bipolar disorder came about when he was about 12, 13, 14. So had him tested. School was a trigger. He had ADD. He had, you know, lots of anxiety. And slowly we noticed this, you know, bipolar. And that's a very, very hard diagnosis.
Yeah.
And a lot of doctors won't diagnose it. I mean, they just don't do it.
You mean especially in that age? Is that
in that age. I mean, it's very common for little boys to be, you know, they're wild child.
Yeah.
And a lot of especially boys, are diagnosed with ADD. So I didn't worry about that so much. But
right.
as his behaviors got more outlandish, it just – it worried me. And as he always told me that pot should be legal because it made him feel normal. And I always said, well, when you go to get a job and a drug test, you're going to fail it and you're not going to get the job.
Oh, right, yeah.
And so – but he was like, but, Mom, it's the only thing that makes me feel normal. So he kept smoking pot, and he, you know, was obviously doing it behind our backs. And he ended up going to several outpatient programs.
Yeah.
He ended up going to outpatient programs, inpatient programs, because pot was really, I mean, he was addicted to smoking pot.
Right.
And that just wasn't legal.
And when you put him in those programs, was he against it? Was he like, I need this? Like, how?
He was so against it.
Yeah.
Really, really against it. I would take him, you know, he would be acting, there was one time when he was acting very strange in the car and he started, you know, I didn't know what he was on and he was like beating the window and beating the door. And I just drove to the hospital. And, you know, he just ran away. He just wouldn't have anything to do with it.
So he started to have behaviors that couldn't be controlled, that you didn't know what was going on, that was yes. that became evident that was more than just a rambunctious kid who doesn't like school, who maybe has yes. anxious behaviors around people or things. It seemed more serious.
It was definitely got more and more serious, and the drugs got more serious.
Right.
Then he went into opioids.
Right.
And, you know, we got him an apartment in the city when he had finally graduated from high school. Mm. We got him an apartment in the city, and he was supposedly going to college and taking classes, and he never attended. But school was a huge trigger for him, like it is for so, so many. You know,
trigger in the way that it made him feel stupid. He didn't like the interacting with other people.
He loved interacting with other people.
Okay.
Richard was very, very funny. Mm-hmm. He had this quick wit that would just come out when you least expected it. Mm-hmm. He was funny. He was charming. He could talk to anybody. And he was Ralph Lauren model good looking. Mm. But he had no idea.
Right.
He absolutely had no idea.
His self-esteem didn't feel that way.
It didn't.
Yeah.
No, it didn't. So we ended up, he went to four woods programs, the wilderness programs, which is like camping therapy, but it can be a little intense.
Are these the ones where somebody would kidnap you and take you where you don't know what's happening and you go for 21 days and at the end they really feel great about it, but at the beginning they didn't know where they were going, or he knew that these were things he was going to do?
He knew these were things he was going to do.
Okay.
The first time he went to wilderness therapy, he actually was in a psych ward. And okay. because he was on a drug and he was, again, just acting very, very strange, I was very concerned and took him. And then that's where a couple guys came and took him to a rehab.
Right.
And unfortunately, it sounds really, really harsh, but when you're a mother who is just looking for all the answers and tirelessly research, whenever things would turn upside down, it was, okay, is there another rehab? Is there another
right.
Therapeutic boarding school? But no matter where he went, he always wanted to come home.
Yeah.
And he never wanted to be there. Hmm. Until things got very out of control. So as a young man, mm-hmm. he would do really, really wild things. One was he ran away from home when he was, well, he's a little bit younger. He was 17 at the time, and I was going out of town for a week, and he was going with the three kids to his dad's, and he didn't want to go. He wanted to stay alone.
Mm-hmm.
A 17-year-old who has a drug problem wanted to stay at home.
Sure, he did.
And so I was like, that's not happening. So Richard found a girl at the high school who knew of an anarchy group.
Hmm.
This is a crazy story because we are in a conservative town. Her father was like a prominent doctor at the hospital. And he, of course, finds the one person in the entire school that knows this.
Hmm.
And she said, they can help you disappear. You don't have to go anywhere this week. So he went with this girl to the city, and I was supposed to be going away. I thought he was in school, noticed I was about to leave for the airport, my money was missing out of my wallet, and I was like, knew it was Richard. I knew it was. There was no one else. He had gone down to the city. They dyed his hair blonde, and he looked a lot like Big Bird.
Oh, my goodness.
And they smashed his phone, got him a Go phone and a new ID, and they put him on a bus to New York City. And gave him a list of groups in New York City that he could stay with. So there he went, you know, thinking this is a really grand idea.
Mm.
And he left. And so we didn't know where he was.
Now, let me ask you a question before you finish the story. I'm curious what, and if you even know this, if you shared it with you, what he was running from, what the doctors or the therapy people were telling him was going on. You know, when I was 12, my mother sent me to a therapeutic boarding school. during that therapeutic boarding school in Running Springs, California, which I did graduate from, but it was pretty miserable being there. I mean, the stuff you go through. I was put on one of those wilderness adventures myself. So I know from both perspectives, me having gone through it, what that was like, but also from a parent's perspective and my mother, why she did it or why she thought she did it or why the help. She had no other option. I mean, she needed to figure out what the story was and how to help, because as a single mother, she didn't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. But I'm just curious what you think he was running from and towards. Do you know what I mean? By not going through the programs, by not learning the lessons, by not finishing, you know, wanting to be in school, or where did he feel like he wanted to be, do you think?
He wanted to party and he wanted to stay up. Seriously, he didn't want to go to any more rehabs. He just wanted to have fun with his friends.
Right.
And he didn't want to be with a parent at the time. He wanted to be on his own. And when I said, no, you cannot stay alone, he really at that time was all about the party, the drugs.
So it was a rebellion. He just wanted to
It was
to
a rebellion, and he, you know, was an addict. Mm-hmm. So the addiction had started.
Right.
And so whatever he could do to find
those friends.
Yeah. Those drugs, the party, the fun, whatever he could do at that time is what he did.
Right.
And so he ended up in New York, didn't know where he was. He called the hotline. Of course, he's very dramatic. Mm. You have to remember this about him. Mm. And he loved shock and awe. Like, he didn't just borrow a friend's phone. He ended up at a friend's college dorm room in New York, called the runaway hotline, and got me on the phone because it couldn't just be a regular phone, right?
Oh, my gosh.
And so he said, I'm sorry, I want to come home. So I did not send him a plane ticket. I did not make it easy for him at that point. I said, you got there on a bus, so I'm sending you enough money for food and a bus ticket. Mm-hmm. He took the bus and a train and ended up back at our house. Mm-hmm. And 2 weeks later, as I was walking through my foyer, kind of thinking, how is this my life? Mm-hmm. You know, how did we get here? Mm-hmm. How did I get here? How did my kids get here? Mm-hmm. I was sort of pausing, and I look out the front window, and there's two black Suburbans that slowly pull up in front of my house. And I'm like, is this like Men in Black? Like, what's happening? Right. And three people, two men and a woman, got out in suits, with one with a briefcase. And I'm like, is this some sort of punked? I mean, am I on YouTube? Like, what is happening? Right. And they came up to the front door and, boop, FBI. We'd like to talk to Richard, please.
Oh, gosh.
I'm like, you want to talk to Richard? Next thing I know, Richard and his friend, high as kites, are running through the house. They jump in the car. I'm like, don't leave. He's like, I don't want to go to rehab again, Mom.
Oh, he thought they were coming to get him
yes.
for rehab.
I ran out the door and literally spread eagle on top of the car, like, Richard, you get out of that car right now. I said, the FBI wants to talk to you.
And
he goes, well, why didn't you tell me that in the first place, Mom? Of course I want to talk to them. He gets out.
That was less scary than going to rehab.
Oh, yeah.
Who knew what they were there for? Did he?
He didn't know.
Right.
He didn't know. So he's like, I'd love to talk to the FBI. Because
like, this is so fun.
Like, this is so fun.
Right.
So he gets out and shakes their hand. I'm Richard. It's nice to meet you. One of them, I'm going to turn my beef stew off the stove because it's like boiling over at this point. Mm-hmm. And one follows me in the kitchen, two go in the living room with Richard. And I hear the words, undercover. And I ran into the living room, and Richard's got his arms up and he's talking, and they're sitting, he's holding court. And he said, Mom, they want me to go undercover in that anarchy group. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Isn't that cool? Richard, over my dead body, are you doing that? FBI, thank you so much for visiting today. Here's the front door.
Right.
So those types of stories happened from that time when he was 17 until the time he passed away at 24.
Right.
There is a world of opportunity out there beyond the typical 9-to-5 where purpose and grit and the American spirit come together in the Peace Corps. It's been called the toughest job you'll ever love. Tough because it asks so much of you. And the love part is knowing your hard work can transform lives and build bridges across cultures. After 65 years, the Peace Corps is still the toughest job you'll ever love. Explore opportunities in more than 60 countries and apply at peacecorps.gov/serve. That's peacecorps.gov/serve.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. Forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
I used to just go with whatever meat looked good or was on sale at the grocery store. But now that I've experienced the exceptional quality, flavor, and convenience that you can get from Omaha Steaks, I'm never going back. They can build a custom food plan based on your schedule, which means less food waste and stocking up on high-quality proteins to always have on hand. With Omaha Steaks in your freezer, you're always just minutes away from a quality dinner, whether it's Taco Tuesday or a weekend feast. Taste the Omaha Steaks difference and never settle for grocery proteins again. Get flavorful, high-quality proteins delivered by visiting omahasteaks.com, plus $35 off when you use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, code YUM. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to omahasteaks.com and use promo code YUM at checkout for $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply.
I'm just curious of two things. How was your ex-husband handling all this in his house or coming over to your house? What was his involvement? And also, the other two children, because they weren't causing such a ruckus,
yes,
did they get forgotten during this? Or
no.
Or they were very much involved with their brother and figuring out what was going on?
They were sheltered from as much of it as I could because I wanted them to have a more normal childhood.
Mm-hmm. So they were in school.
They were in school. You know, Nick was three years younger than mm-hmm. Richard, and so he would get text messages like, "Oh, I hear your brother's down on a yacht with Wiz Khalifa on Lake Michigan," mm-hmm. and he'd be like, "Mom, you won't believe." So I would get those types of stories and things. But my daughter was very, very young. Mm-hmm. She was like first, second, third grade.
Right.
So she doesn't remember a lot of it, but she does remember when I told her that we had a possum family living under our front steps because Richard was smoking pot on the side of the house.
Oh.
And she's like, "What's that smell?" I'm like, "It's possums or skunks or something like that. I'm not really sure, but we're just going to leave them be because right. they can live there."
Right. And your ex-husband?
And my ex-husband. He was involved. He was very involved with all three kids. Mm-hmm. He was always trying to get Richard healthy and suggesting things to do. Mm-hmm. The other kids were really busy. Nick was playing hockey, and he played football and hockey and lacrosse and had great grades. But, you know, those two flew under the radar, right. And they did normal, like, sketchy kid things.
Right.
The normal drinking and having parties at my house. You know, those
right.
normal things.
So they saw Richard as someone who was living the fast life, not necessarily like he was a mess and he was missing and he was...
As they got a little bit older, well, Nicholas always knew that there was a problem. Uh-huh. And as my daughter got older, she definitely, after some of the shenanigans or being in a rehab and walking out after 2 days saying, I'm cured, she would say, Mom, he's just not making good choices. Mm. So they were very close to Richard when he was home. Mm. I did have to kick him out once because the drugs were getting to be too much and I didn't want them to affect the other kids.
Sure, right.
So I did that as well.
So I know at some point Richard does take a turn and gets clean. How did that happen?
That happened... really because almost the courts demanded it. So okay. He had been using heroin, and I had no idea he was using heroin. I know that might sound like I'm stupid, but I really did not know that became his drug of choice. Hmm. And he was home in his room in the suburbs because he always had a place. And he was calling me at 6 in the morning. My phone kept ringing, and I picked it up, and he whispered, hospital. Mm. And I ran upstairs and he had a bucket and I just assumed he had the flu, of course. So I grabbed him. I grabbed the bucket and paper towel, put him in the car, drove to the hospital. And when they were taking him back, now he was 21 at this point. Mm. When they were taking him back, I always went back with him. Can your mother come back? He went, no, no. And so they put me in one of those little rooms where they tell you bad news. He was overdosing on heroin.
Oh, wow.
And when I got to
and
see him.
And he knew it? I mean, he knew enough it. To say, okay, yeah.
He knew it. So he was in the hospital for about 5 days. And, of course, everyone at the social worker at the hospital was telling him it's not a matter of if, it's when, if you keep on this path of using heroin. And
And they must have been the ones to tell you it was heroin, right?
Yes. One of the nurses came in, popped her head in, and did say to me, your son's been on a 5-day heroin binge. And my heart dropped. And then I felt stupid that I didn't know that. But how would I know? He was living in the city. He had come back late at night mm-hmm. and showed up. Maybe he knew something's wrong. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So after that happened and he came home and I'm nursing him to health and we're watching movies together and really bonding, he took a shower, got dressed. He used to say, love you, Mom. I'll be safe. Mm-hmm. He got up and he, 2 days later, was leaving. And I literally got down on my hands and knees and begged him. Don't leave. Something bad's going to happen if you leave. Oh, no, Mom. I'm cool. I'm safe. I'll be safe. Love you. Mm-hmm. So I stayed awake all night. And sure enough, at 5 a.m., I did get a call from the jail in Chicago at 27th and whatever that is. It's a mm-hmm. very bad place. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, come get me. So I went. And he got out and I said, is this bottom? Have you hit bottom now? Mm-hmm. And he was like, ugh, Mom, they were calling me Bieber, Justin Bieber in there. They're like, hey, Bieber, what are you doing in here? And he just laughed. He thought that was funny. Hmm. The court date came. I still want to hug the judge. She said, welcome to the world of felonies where your life is no longer your own. Hmm. It's mine. I still want to hug her. Hmm. We got permission to
go. That scared him enough, is what you're saying.
He wish I could see him, like, shaking up there. You know, and I was there, yeah. And we asked if he could leave the state to go to Hazleton in Minnesota. It's a place I always wanted him to go. And the judge offered him there's an 8-month rehabilitation program in Chicago. Mm-hmm. They would rather rehabilitate than put people in jail, sure. Obviously. So he did go to Hazleton. And she said, of course, what's going to happen after that? Well, he got his help. And he went to Hazleton and he got sober. And he was sober for the last 3 years of his life.
Wow.
Which was a huge, huge gift to our family.
Right.
He stayed in St. Paul, Minnesota, because a lot of people do. They don't want you to go back to your old friends and your old habits. So they he had a great life there. He was sober. He had a great job. He was managing a few GNC stores and was really doing well from, you know, from what I could tell.
And had found someone he wanted to spend his life with.
Yes.
Which obviously gave him some sense of purpose. And especially if that person wasn't using, that's somebody that probably was helping him stay clean.
Yes. So he had met a woman in Chicago years before who they were very close friends. Mm-hmm. And she moved to Las Vegas and became a dancer and made great money out there. And then she started visiting Richard in St. Paul. Mm-hmm. And they fell in love and got engaged. And Richard had come out to me when he was 21 that he was gay. I had no idea. As close as we were, I had no idea. Mm. And, you know, of course, he pulled the hi, Mom. He called me, Mom, I have a friend who's gay. Like, do you think his mom would want to know?
Oh, gosh.
And I was like, yes, I think it's mom.
Asking for a friend.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I'm gay. And I was so relieved. I was so happy that he came out with this truth, because I felt like there was something in him that just there. What was it?
Right.
That
so
he
maybe
was,
this was what he was running from. Didn't know how to handle, and maybe the telling you this could really help him.
Yes,
yeah.
And it did. And he wanted advice on how to tell everybody, and we talked about it. And you know, we all we loved him, you know, unconditionally, obviously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they got engaged, and it turns out that Maria was a transgender.
Mm-hmm.
So she was born Edward and made a full transition with all the surgeries. It was very, very, I thought she was a very, very brave person to do that, because it's so painful and, you know, there's just, you have to really, really want
right.
to make that change.
Did you know that over 70 million Americans suffer from chronic sleep problems? Sleep just isn't about rest. It's vital for hormone health, stress reduction, and overall well-being. I used to struggle so much with my sleep that I became addicted to sleeping pills. And then that only took care of the problem of falling asleep. Staying asleep was a whole nother problem. But then I discovered Dreamies. Dreamies is designed specifically for women, helping to support your body's natural rhythms through every hormonal shift. It's a powerful combination of melatonin, ashwagandha, and magnesium. It calms the mind, relaxes the body, and promotes deep, restorative sleep. Now I wake up feeling refreshed and balanced, and I no longer need those prescriptions. I fall asleep easily and without a worry. If you've been tossing and turning, it's time to let Dreamies transform your nights and your life. Prioritize your health with the power of sleep and take back your energy one night at a time. Dreamies, because every woman deserves deep, restful sleep.
So he really connected with someone who had been through something. And
yes.
I'm sure that resonated with him. And that's part of their connection.
Yes.
It seems.
It seems. And I wondered, I didn't get a chance to ask him why he wasn't marrying a man, why he was marrying her. But I just didn't get the chance.
Right.
I think it's probably because sometimes it's easier, I've been told, to present as male and female. I really, I believe that that's what it was for him. And he fell in love with her.
Right.
So there was, he was very much in love with her. And so, you know, he wanted to get married at our home in Lake Forest, Illinois, in the backyard. And I'm a little bit of a Martha Stewart kind of a girl.
Uh-huh.
I like to entertain. So I was thrilled. I was thrilled that he seemed to be getting better and making a nice life for himself. But I didn't want him to move to Las Vegas, because I kept telling him that, you know, that's a place that you might not be able to stay sober.
Right, right.
So
at the time where things turn in your family, everything seemed great.
Everything seemed great. So
no red flags.
There were no red flags. There were green flags.
Mm.
You know, it was him He sent me the night before. He sent me a photo of himself wearing his topsiders. He was kind of a preppy dresser and his little ruffler and shirt. And he said, grilling vegan sausages, listening to Barry White with some cheap box of wine, you know, and it's a great day. And it was a great photo. And I thought, maybe my boy is taking these baby steps, maybe at a beautiful condo. They had a room for me, which I thought was cool. And it felt like he was finally finding his place.
Yeah.
Can I go forward?
Yeah.
The next day, his fiance found him taken by suicide. She called me, frantic, told me which hospital he went to. And I called the hospital and waited a long time. And the doctor got on and said, what do you know? And I said, I know he tried to, at the time, take his own life. And he said, there's no easy way to tell you that your son died tonight.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
So let's talk about, I don't want to live in that space for very long.
No.
But I know that a lot of people who have been through something like this can understand what you were feeling in that moment. Can you just share a little bit about what it's like to get a call like that, to know that from that moment on, your life will never be the same?
I thought that the doctor was wrong. I was sort of thinking, what is he talking about? What does that mean? I just thought he was wrong. But then part of me believed him because I went into shock for a very, very long time.
How did you end up telling your younger children?
They were in Nashville, Tennessee, visiting their dad. So he had to tell them, and then they had to fly home.
Right.
And I remember my son saying, Mom, why are you so calm? And I don't know why. I think I was just, I never knew what shock was.
Yeah.
You're just kind of numb, and you're just kind of like a robot. But I have to tell you, so Richard was so funny that within 2 days after he died, he had us in stitches, which sounds weird. We went to the cemetery to pick out a spot. My mom and dad are divorced. My mom and dad were never in the same room together for like 26 years. They were both there holding my hands. My husband was there, and my ex-husband, Richard's dad, was there. And I'm looking around like, this is different. And we're looking, you know, and we found a spot. And then my mom said, you know, would you mind if I buy a spot? Oh, sure, Mom. I said to my husband, let's buy a spot too. Right here, we'll be together. And then my ex-husband says, oh, well, my wife doesn't care where we're buried. Let's, you know, we'll be next to Tony. We'll smoke cigars. And then my dad said, well, there's a tree over here, but could they cut the roots of this tree so my wife and I could be over here? And my mom leaned over to me and she said, I'm going to be with my ex-husband and you're going to be with your ex-husband for eternity? And I looked up and I said, Richard, you just played out the funniest Seinfeld episode ever.
Absolutely.
And it was the only thing that made us laugh, to the point where when we were at home and someone would tell the story, like literally we were laughing, crying. It was, it really brought us comic relief and
brought you together.
And brought us all together.
Yeah.
And he has since that day. We are together for all birthdays and celebrations.
That's amazing.
And he always wondered, you know, why can't they be together? They should be together. Well, they're together now.
Right. So I want to talk about grief for a second. Everybody grieves differently depending on what they're going through, who they've lost, how the loss happens, but it's a universal feeling. And I think there are steps in that grief. Like you said, you don't believe it. Wait, this doesn't make sense. This can't be. Into stages where there's a lot of numbness.
Yes.
And also fear of having regular things happen. Eating, is that okay? Laughing, is that okay? You know, feeling almost guilty about that stuff. when I was younger, I was 15, and I was at boarding school. I was at that therapeutic boarding school mm-hmm. that I mentioned earlier. And it's interesting that you gave me something about butterflies because somehow in a conversation, there was a girl at the school whose father had died by suicide, now that I'm thinking about it. And she talked a lot about when you see a butterfly, it's a soul. Mm-hmm. And she came to get me during lunch, this girl, Jennifer. I haven't thought about the story in a long time. But Jennifer came at our lunch break at this therapeutic boarding school where there's rigid, rigid rules. And that's the only time you could run up to get extra clothes, a sweatshirt, whatever. And you have to always be accompanied by someone. And I was just old enough in the school. I'd been there a year and a half, so I could go by myself. So I ran up to the dorm, was getting a sweatshirt, and Jennifer walks in and says, "Tim, the headmaster wants to speak to you." So I walked down with her, and you have to walk down this path. And all these butterflies were circling around, and she stops, and she said, "Did you see that?" And I said, "Yeah." And she was, like, trying to hold in tears because she knew what they were about to tell me, but I didn't, you know.
Oh.
And anyways, so I walk into my headmaster's room, and he essentially says, "Your father died."
Wow.
And I didn't know how to take that. I was very quiet, and, you know, it didn't hit me. And I'll just to fast forward the story, I remember for at least a month, and this was very similar when my fiance was killed, for at least a month, you know, you have so many people around you.
Yes.
Have so many things going on. It's hard to find a moment where you are just in that grief and that misery and that loneliness. And it with my father especially, I remember it was like almost a month later, I was in the shower. And it just hit me out of nowhere, and I started crying, thinking this loss is really big. I'm going to go through my life without this person in my life. How do I do that, you know? And that was the first time I had to go through something like that as a young child, and that was a terrible loss, you know? And to this day, listen, I mean, I've done many things to kind of deal with the loss of having a fiance killed, losing a father to cocaine overdose, which, you know, essentially was an overdose, but really, you know, I think it was somewhat similar to a suicide in the way that he was killing himself. You know, he
yes.
knew what could happen, and he did it for whatever reasons. He couldn't face the pain. He couldn't feel that pain, couldn't feel good in his own body, which
yes.
I want to hear from you because I know you say it in a great way or in a way that people can understand. But and so that grief process for me has been many years. For many years, I avoided it. I ignored it. For many years, I flip-flopped that pain into other things. I ran in a different direction
right.
and ran from it. I got into terrible relationships from it. I, you know, all these different things. But finally now, you know, I'm turning 50 this month. I've really learned what grief is, and you have to sit in it. You know, you have to live in it.
You
and
do.
For me, I don't know that grief ever leaves. When I talk about losing my fiance, I was 26 at the time. You
wow.
know, I've lived just as long, you know, now I'm going to be 50, like I said. And I was only with him. He was in my life for 3 years. It's taken this long, you know, the emotion is still in my throat when I talk about that loss.
Of course.
And who knows what would have happened if life had gone on. We could have been divorced, hated each other, never spoken again. But that grief can stump you in life. You can get stuck in it,
yes.
and it can prevent you from living either the life that you could, should, want to. And for me, it was like stuck up here. Anyway, so I just wanted to share that with you about my lessons of grief. And I've learned you have to live alongside of it somewhat. You have
you
to
do.
It doesn't go away. You have to learn how to live with it. And also, it's interesting for me how to talk to people with it because, you know, there's so many people that are like, oh, what can I do? Can I, you know, let me know if I could do these things. For me, I've learned someone should just do it. You know, if they're going to bring
correct.
The food, if they're going to drive
just
you somewhere.
Do it. Don't ask
yeah.
because you will never say yes.
Right. And also, you know, those comments of like, oh, they're in a better place, that's not necessarily helpful.
That is – okay. So I 100% agree. First, I'd like to say I am so sorry.
Thank you.
For two unbelievably catastrophic losses in your life.
Thank you.
And it does take years. You have to do the work.
Yeah.
And sometimes we avoid the work, right? We put it in a box to the left and don't talk about it, don't think about it, and just – but it comes, and then it'll come crashing down on you. The things people say are unbelievable. Mm-hmm. People, I believe, have a great intention and a good heart, but the worst thing that someone said to me was, "No one's getting out of here alive."
Oh, right. A terrible thing.
It's a terrible thing to say.
Well, we're all going to die.
We're all going to die, so you would better get used to it.
Yeah, it would have happened at some point. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or he's in a better place. And then in my mind, I would never say it, but in my head, I'm like, have you seen the other place? Like, what does it look like?
Right. Right.
But I think people should just stop it after they say, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Stop after I'm sorry is how I have felt.
And affirm their feelings. This is terrible. No one should have to live through this.
Yes.
You know, I understand what you're feeling. You know, those are the things I think you should say.
Yes. So as far as grief, I...
Wait one second for the... Sorry for the sound. I don't know if you guys can hear that sound, but I'm going to wait. Okay. Sounds like they're apprehending the guy right down the street for stopping so abruptly.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
So shortly after I lost Richard, I went to see a grief therapist, and she was actually a suicide grief therapist, which is really what I needed at the time. And she, what grief counseling taught me was so valuable. She gave me a schedule that I should follow because you sort of have to learn how to get out of bed, how to eat, how to do things again, because you're so overwhelmed by this huge, huge loss. And the other thing that she taught me was, and I think this can help people, that a person that leaves by suicide, it's like there's a fire burning inside of them, and they just, it goes on, the pain goes on for so, so long, they have to do the only thing they know how to do, and that's to leave the pain behind.
Right.
And the other thing that, I mean, therapy had was vital in me getting out there again, you know, I kind of thought, was there something I could do? And I think a lot of people have guilt about what could I have done? What years and years of work taught me after walking in my grief, talking in my grief, sitting in my grief, doing all the grief work, you know, you kind of go, well, why didn't these programs help him?
Right.
Why couldn't the unrelenting love of all of his family help him? And he was getting married. You know, he had this life he had built. But what therapy taught me is that his suicide was unstoppable.
Wow. Yeah. That's really powerful. I think there are a lot of misconceptions about suicide. Some people say people are doing it for attention, for all sorts of reasons. But what you're saying really makes it clear, at least in this case, it was something that no matter what, in his good moments, in his bad moments, that pain was still there, and he couldn't get rid of it. And it was a decision he felt like he really had to make.
He felt he couldn't live on drugs, and he couldn't live sober, because he lived both ways, and he lived both ways in pain.
And I always hear, when you see these programs about suicide or these even made-for-TV movies, at the end it says, say something to someone, just tell someone, call this hotline.
Yes.
But for people really struggling with this, it seems like that's almost, you know, not a realistic thing, because they are keeping this to themselves because they're planning this out. It's something they want to do.
It's something they want to do. He planned, I believe, that whole Barry White, listening to Barry White and smiling and, you know, acting really happy. He knew what he was going to do. And there was evidence found in his apartment that he was planning it. And then when I got his phone and I went through his phone, he was planning it.
Isn't that interesting, after the fact, to try to put the pieces together? I mean, I've done that now in two situations. And, you know, to look at their phones, to, you know, my father didn't have, they didn't have phones back then, but like that. But it was more looking at notes, looking. So 2 days after they let me leave the therapeutic boarding school and go to his house. Mm-hmm. And I was looking where things were. I was seeing what was in the shower. I was seeing what was on his bedside table. And to kind of put those pieces together really was helpful for me. I mean, I didn't realize it till later, but it was a sense of closure. I needed to know what he saw. I needed to know where he was at, the smells, the sounds, what was going on outside the window. I don't know. It just, for me, made me feel closer. So did that help you kind of with getting a feeling of being closer to him because you were in the same place he was?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it answered a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. I also have stayed close friends with a really cute family that he was friends with, and they've weren't able to have children, and now they have four. So Richard didn't know any of that, but he was very close with them, and they live in St. Paul and visit me with their kids. And I feel they feel connected to him, and I feel connected to them. And it's been a really, really great relationship.
Yeah.
Too hard to see the fiance. I did that a few times, and we both just got really upset. And I tried doing it with a couple of my friends, just not one-on-one, and it was still the same. And we both agreed that it would be better for us, both of us, on our journey. She used to come up and leave roses on his, white roses on his grave, so I always knew when she was there. Mm. But, you know, I always wish her well and happiness, but she and I are a little bit better this way.
Right. It's interesting, after my fiancé died, there was a lot of people that had blame, even though terrorists were what killed my fiancé,
yes.
But for whatever reason, there was blame. So I was never close to the family, which to this day still is upsetting to me, because that's, those are the people you think should be the closest to you and understand what that loss is like. I'm still friends with some of the guys who were not at work that day that he worked with, that got out of the building, whatever it is. And to me, that, I mean, that's great, but it is hard because everyone does want to blame somebody, and everyone has their own feelings about what happened, and or sometimes it's just too hard to be around someone who was there, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I want to talk about finding joy after this, because I know you've done the work, and I want to get into that for people to listen to, because some people are listening to this and thinking, okay, well, I'm in this. I know these feelings. You know, people say with time it eases pain, but I can't get out of bed, whatever. I'm stuck. Explain what pivotal moments you went through or created for yourself to make the path for that joy for yourself, to learn how to live again after this loss.
Well, the first year was very fuzzy, but I ended up walking. I ended up just every day getting up, and I would go for a walk. And, you know, at the time I was living in Chicago year-round, and I would, you know, in the middle of the winter, I would just put the clothes on and get out there and walk 6 miles. And I would make it to, we live on a lake, Lake Forest, and I would walk, my goal was to walk to the lake, which was 6 miles from my house. The water was very soothing, the sounds, the air, the fresh air. That was my first step in really starting to try to live again. And then I started to see amazing signs. And
tell me about some of those.
Some of the signs. Well, I will tell you that monarch butterflies visit me all the time if I'm at the cemetery. The first, my first birthday after Richard left, friends of mine picked me up, and we went down to a restaurant that was on the 8th floor of outdoor restaurant in Chicago. And I was just sort of sitting there, you know, ordered tofu because Richard would have. And all of a sudden, this huge monarch butterfly comes, circles my head, dances around the table, circles the table, dances around my head again, and then flutters off. And I said, I looked up and I said, did everyone see that? And they were, we were all in shock.
Yeah.
We were all in shock. So the butterfly, I wear a butterfly every day that my mom gave me. The butterfly is definitely, and I know a lot of people are comforted by maybe a squirrel or a cardinal.
Right.
And that is very comforting, very, very comforting. And so signs started coming, and they were pretty, pretty incredible.
And you believe in these signs. They help comfort you.
I believe in the signs because I believe that there's an unstoppable power of love. Mm-hmm. And love is unstoppable. Mm-hmm. And love is around all the time, and even in death, and even in your grief.
Yeah.
And those are, that's very comforting.
Yeah.
And finding joy, you know, for a long time, feeling guilt when I would start to just feel a little teeny bit of joy. I would go, no, I can't. Nope, I can't smile. Mm. I can't do that because I'm in grief. And then you just do the work.
Yeah.
And you find joy again. I went on a 60th birthday trip with 16 women from around the country that have been friends for almost, new friends from Florida, but all my life.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that I can say I laughed for 4 days and didn't feel guilty about it.
Right.
And it was, talk about therapeutic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've talked about walking. You've talking about, you know, finding some strategies to, like, get out of bed. What would you say are some coping mechanisms, like tangible things that people that are stuck could do to move forward?
Well, the therapy, obviously, the walking. I do have a book that really changed my life.
Oh, yeah. Talk about that.
And I actually have one
for you. I want to see it, yeah. No, that's okay.
It's Healing After Loss by Martha J. Hickman. And it's daily meditations for working through your grief. So there's...
And I know you've given this book to so many people.
You've
lived by it.
I live by this book because it took me a long time to pick. You know, people give you so many great books.
Yeah.
And I put them in a pile, you know, kind of like, what am I going to do that? Like, really kind of books didn't seem like they would be a thing. Mm. And one day I picked Healing After Loss up and I opened it up to the day. There's a day, there's a little quote from someone, and then there's a meditation or an inspirational message. And I sat down in my garden room and opened it up, mm-hmm. and something shifted in me. I can't explain it because everything in the world looked the same, but something shifted in me. So I kept up with the book. I actually, 8 years now, I've been reading this book every day. It's been amazing. I've sent it to, the first time I sent it was when another family lost a son. And I wrote a quote, or I wrote in the beginning of the book, may this book bring you comfort in your own time. Mm-hmm. Because everybody has to do it in their own time.
That's right.
And after I sent that book, a month later, someone else had passed away. It was a family I didn't know. Mm-hmm. I sent the book. And then in the ensuing months, I went on to send the book, signed that way, to people I knew and to people I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And it gave me such a sense of accomplishment getting this really amazing book mm-hmm. into the hands of people
yeah.
who I thought could use it.
Right.
And I ended up ordering my first case, and it felt like a purpose.
Right.
It felt like, as I said, such an accomplishment. Then the thank you notes came, which of course they did, but I wasn't even thinking about thank you notes. Mm-hmm. And I put them in a heart-shaped box that I was a gift. I got a gift from our good friend Epi Letterer, who is known to the world as Ann Lander. She's a very close friend of ours. Mm-hmm. And it was special to put the thank you notes in her box. Mm-hmm. And then I would keep the box of thank you notes and the books in the foyer in our home. And every time I walked in and out of the house, I really felt this circle of giving and this circle of purpose. And I still feel it
right
today.
So a lot of people talk about how life is different from the day someone dies or that loss, whatever it is for someone yes. that they're grieving. And there was life before, and then there's life after. And what I think is interesting and sort of a summary of how you continue on in life after is finding purpose, which yes. is where I think you are now. You're talking about the book. You've been doing a lot of work with different, what would you call them? like the communities within people that have lost someone to suicide and helping. I mean, community seems like it is such a big thing in helping with the grief.
Grief. Yeah. And, you know, it's a grief of a mother, father, son, whoever. There is so much, you know, there's so many survivors in the world. Mm. And if I can get out into the world and they can take one thing away, that is, then I've done my job. It's just become my purpose.
Right. So talk about, you've been working on a book for a while.
Yes.
Talk about that book.
I have been working on a book. I call it Unstoppable.
Great name. Thank you. Now that you told that story, too, about Unstoppable, I think it's a great name.
Thank you. It's the story of a son's wild ride with addiction and a mother's journey from grief to joy. Mm-hmm. And it starts, you know, through really when Richard was very, very young and goes, you know, in all of, as I said, his shenanigans. I make fun of myself in the book a lot. So it's not a Debbie Downer book. Mm-hmm. It actually has a lot of humor in it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't pass away until like three quarters of the way through the book because mm-hmm. he had such a large life. We had a large life together. And passes away. Okay, that's sad. And then when all the nudges, I call the butterflies coming and, mm-hmm. and signs that you get, I call them nudges. Mm-hmm. When you get these nudges, it's magic.
Yeah. I want to also share one thing about, for me, what I found is after Andy, my fiance, died, I spent a ton of time living my life acting like he was supposed to be there. So like if I was in a cab in New York City, he should have been sitting next to me. We would get past the date that we were supposed to, you know, have our wedding.
That's so
We were supposed to do that day. And I found that I was living life not being in the moment, you know, really being in the – it should have been this way, like going down – a side street of what my life was currently. And I couldn't find the way to be present in the moment. And I won't get into the story, but something happened. A year later, I had to leave work and go sort of on this retreat by myself. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I realized, you know, I found a way to believe that Andy died when he was supposed to die, that I couldn't live my life thinking, well, he was supposed to be 80. We were supposed to be married for all these years and have all these kids. It was so important for me to learn this is his life. That is the life he was given. He lived the best life. There was ups and downs like any other life. And he died. He went out with a bang. He died, you know, and he died knowing how loved he was. I knew that he knew I loved him, and that was really important. And it sounds like Richard was in a place where he knew all these people were at peace with not worrying that he was going to ruin his life, right? That he was at a space where he knew how much he was loved.
He knew. And family members had been out to visit him and said, my father was there with his wife, and they said, wow, we had the best dinner with Richard. He's really found himself. He's come such a long way.
Right.
And that brings people comfort, too.
Mm.
You know, just thinking of those, you know, if you can eventually, you know, bring back those memories and really cherish the memories.
Right.
It's an important step.
Yeah.
And wow, like you coming to the conclusion that's when he was supposed to pass away.
Yeah.
It was huge, and it's huge.
Huge. But also, you know, when I think about it, you know, the pain that Richard was feeling or other people that, you know, take their lives, it seems, and even people that are killed, whatever, I think about it often when I hear these stories, and they're dealing with their own pain. They're mm-hmm. dealing with whatever they are going through. But if they had to think, oh my gosh, my mother is going to have to go through life, that may have kept them alive for quite a while. But,
yes.
You know, at some
it probably
point.
Probably did for a while.
Yeah. At some point, his own pain overcame him. But, you know, knowing that you were going to suffer would have probably been a terrible thing for him. So to know that from him being able to, you know, do what he needed to do, that you are still going to find a purpose and be able to live mm-hmm. Is probably really important to you in your healing.
Yes.
That you could find something from it and not just also die, you know?
Yes.
And so, you know, you told me a story earlier that I loved, and it was about signs and about someone you knew who also had lost
a child. Yes.
Can you tell that story? I love that story.
Okay. I'm going to tell the story. So another family that we were really, really close to, the kids grew up with. I had three children. They had three children. Mm-hmm. As couples, we were friends. And the dads would take the six children skiing over President's Day weekend every year. So our kids really, really knew each other. Mm-hmm. And this friend had a little boutique and had wonderful, it was like a bakery boutique, and had these cute little trinket trays. And at the time, Richard was living in St. Paul. I look down and I see this tray that says, "You miss 100% of the shots you don't take," by Wayne Gretzky. Mm-hmm. An amazing, amazing quote. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I'm going to get this for Richard. I gave it to him. He went, "Wow, cool, Mom." Mm-hmm. And he kept it on his nightstand for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. After he passed, I got a box from his apartment and opened the box, and the tray mm-hmm. was there. Right. I had forgotten about the tray. I hugged the tray, walked around with the tray. It was just very silly, but I was so happy. Mm-hmm. So my friend, where I bought this tray at, moved to California mm-hmm. with her family. And a few years passed, and she called me and said that, unfortunately, sadly, her daughter left by suicide, mm-hmm. and she didn't know what to do. Mm. Anne-Marie, what do I do? So I went. I went to see her. Actually was on and got on the airplane with my little granny, you know, glasses and my needlepoint. Mm-hmm. And this man got on last minute and sat down right next to me and just was chatting with me. And I said to him, "Are you like a doctor mm-hmm. or something?" And he said, "Well, I had a practice and I ran a psych ward for 20 years, but now I'm doing radio and TV." And I was like, "Good for mm-hmm. you." So he said that. And I said, "Well, you're going to be so sorry you sat next to me on this plane ride, because it's 4 hours from Chicago to LA. And yeah, there's a lot of talking to happen."
Right.
He talked to me the entire time. I'm texting my friends, like, "I don't know who this guy is." My one friend said, "Does he have black hair or gray hair and dark glasses?" And I said, "Yes." She goes, "Emery, everybody knows Dr. Drew Pinsky," and that's who was sitting next to me. And he could not have been more delightful, mm-hmm. heartwarming. He gave me the courage to sit in my friend's grief and not my own, right. because I didn't know how to do that. Mm. I'm forever grateful for him to being there. And again, not a coincidence.
Right.
Like we were meant to be together for 4 hours.
So Drew is an amazing, he's a good friend of mine. He's an amazing, amazing person.
I think so too, with my short. And by the way, when I got off the plane, he goes, "My name's Drew, by the way." And I'm like, "Oh, I'm Anne-Marie." We laughed. I think everybody else was like rolling their eyes, but that was funny. So I get to my friend's house and we were sitting outside with a beautiful sunset and we had Chinese food and we had the fortune cookies after, and I opened my fortune cookie and it said, "You have good friends," you know, kind of silly. So we were like, ugh. And then my friend opened hers and her fortune said, "You miss 100% of the shots you don't take." Mm. So after we were stunned for a long time, mm-hmm. I said, "You know, Richard and your daughter are up in heaven, like bantering, giggling back and forth."
And wait, did this woman remember that this was the plate you had bought from her store?
Okay. Yes, she did. And I was like, "They're bantering back and forth. Mm-hmm. They're laughing like, which mom's going to get it?" Like, mm-hmm. And her daughter clearly won. And we just, that, if that is not a nudge, I don't know what is. It was miraculous. We had goosebumps. We were laughing, crying, and then she asked me, "What's the shot you haven't taken?" And I said, "The book."
Right.
"I need to put this all down."
Right. So this is your purpose and will be until it gets published.
Yes.
Yes. Tell me about your life now. You're married.
I'm married mm-hmm. to a really amazing man who I met on Match.com, which is a weird
amazing.
Thing.
That's a whole nother episode.
That's a whole nother episode. Needle in a haystack story.
When did you meet him during this whole process?
I met him, we got married in 2012. So I met him in 2010.
Okay.
And he,
so he was around for a lot of this.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he had two girls and a boy, and I had two girls and a boy. And so at our wedding, I had the children pose like the Brady Bunch, and our Christmas card was the Brady Bunch with Alice in the middle. Oh. And so that's how I explain our family. We're a modern-day Brady Bunch, mm-hmm. and we have a great life together. There's obviously ups and downs, and he's very, very, very supportive.
Yeah.
And he was my rock when Richard passed.
Right.
Rock. And we are now living in Florida mm-hmm. a lot of the time, but also have our home in Chicago mm-hmm. as well. So.
And how are the kids doing, your children?
My kids are doing great. My daughter is in D.C. getting her master's in public health, healthcare policy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Amazing. And do you think that what happened with their brother, was that something that affected them, changed the outcome of their lives?
Yes. Definitely. So for my daughter, she did a lot of trauma therapy
okay.
when it happened. She also has a calling with, she worked at a camp that has severely disabled campers, and she ended up running that.
Oh, wow. So she's good with empathy and patience.
Yes. And, yeah. Yes. And she volunteers a lot, and volunteering has really given her a lot of peace.
Right.
And she's just very, very busy.
Yeah.
And my son, I'm actually a grandmother.
Oh,
I'm a
congratulations.
Nana. Thank you. My son lives with his wife in Nashville.
Amazing.
And little Owen, and he's joy. Oh. He's pure magic. So they're both doing well. You know, I think my son is definitely, you know, he's done a really, really good job. I think it's taken him a little longer mm-hmm. to get there. But as you said, it takes years.
Yeah.
It can take.
I mean, here
I am 8.5 years later.
Yeah.
And it took a long time to get it together. You know, I'm an artist. I was an interior designer by trade. So I'm an artist. I'm not a writer. So all of a sudden I wanted to write a book.
Yeah.
Now I can talk and tell a story. But to put it down on paper is a different thing.
Yeah. What do you think is the biggest misconception about life after loss and finding your joy again? Like, what would you say is something that people don't get right and they should know this?
People think that you should move on
mm-hmm.
or get over it.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And you don't. It's in you. Grief changes shape.
Mm.
It's different at all stages of your life, but it's always with you.
Right.
And you learn how to make it flow in your life with you.
Right. That's amazing. And lastly, I just want to end with, what's something you want us to know about Richard or remember? What's something you remember about him that you want us to know about?
I just want everyone to know he was very, very sensitive and had always thought he would become homeless for some reason.
Mm.
So when he would make sack lunches and put them in his backpack, and he would drive around and sit with the homeless people, and he would sit down. He wouldn't just give them a sandwich. He would sit down and hand them a sandwich and say, "How are you today? Tell me about yourself. Tell me about your life. Mm. How do you become homeless?" And he would sit and listen. And he did this for a very long time. And he had a huge heart, $1 million smile, and is missed every single day. But that memory of him and his huge heart is ingrained. And as I said, love's unstoppable.
Yeah. Well, thank you for letting us hear about him and get to know him.
Thank you.
And I wish you the best of luck on your path that you are taking now. And I can't wait to read the book when it comes out.
Thank you so much for having me. I so appreciate it.
Of course.
So good to meet you.
Me too.
Thank you.
Thank
you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time. Misunderstood.